The Sneetches was published in 1961, the same year freedom riders began taking bus trips throughout the South to test out new laws prohibiting segregation. The Civil Rights Act was still just a few years away, and Dr. Seuss's satirical story about star-bellied and plain-bellied creatures took a clear position against prejudice of all kinds. The yellow star is a reference to the Holocaust. 45 years after its publication, the story of the Sneetches is oddly and sadly still relevant. Reading about Sneetches having stars removed and replaced, I was reminded of Rachel Dolezal. Do you remember her? She is the woman who was in the news so much last summer, a white woman who has represented herself as African American for most of her adult life. What was particularly provocative about her story was that she was a civil rights activist, president of her local NAACP chapter, and she had taught Black studies classes at the college level. It says, though she did not know, could not imagine how to be a white person who is a civil rights activist, an ally to Black communities, and knowledgeable about Black history and art. She couldn't figure out how to do that, and so her solution was to pretend to be Black. Pretending to be Black, then she could figure out how to be an activist and a racial justice leader. This is not how she describes why, you know, how she came to do that. This is my imagining. And it's also possible, really possible, that she couldn't bear to not be the expert, right? A white person can't be an expert on what it is to be Black. But white people, and I'm going to make a generalization here, and I'm going to stand by it. White people like to be experts and leaders, even in racial justice work, and we don't like to admit there's things we can't fully know and comprehend. So instead of Rachel Dolezal learning how to be an ally and learning how to support the work of Black leaders and activists, she pretended to be Black so she could be the leader and the expert on what it is to be Black. No wonder so many people were and are so deeply, deeply offended by her actions. And her inability to understand the offense illustrates why pretending to be Black is not the same as being Black. If nothing else, the strange and still unfolding story of Rachel Dolezal points toward the limits and struggles of what it is to be white. If you are a white person interested in or committed to racial justice, and if you keep yourself informed via the internet, you will likely have noticed an unprecedented amount of writing recently directed at white people about white privilege, white ignorance, white rage, and white identity. These are a handful of headlines I found in a quick search of articles being shared on Facebook. These have all been written in the past 2 years. And this is just a smattering. 18 things white people seem to not understand because white privilege. 10 examples that prove white privilege protects white people in every aspect imaginable. 11 ways white America avoids taking responsibility for its racism. 20 examples that prove white privilege protects white people from the police. Dear white people, laughing is not a crime. 11 things white people need to realize about race. Why white people see Black boys like Tamir Rice as older, bigger, and guiltier than they really are. I don't know what to do with good white people. It goes on and on. I couldn't find data about the increase in writing about white people, but my sense is that we're seeing a big change in just the past few years with the death of Trayvon Martin in 2012 and the activism of the Black Lives Matter movement. Among the most serious of recent articles is an opinion piece in the New York Times published on Christmas Eve just last month, called Dear White America. It is written by George Yancey, a professor of philosophy at Emory University and an author and editor of numerous books on racial justice issues. His article was written as a personal reflection after he had conducted a series of interviews with 19 prominent philosophers and public intellectuals on the issue of race. All of those had been published in the New York Times. Interviews with people like Cornel West, bell hooks, and Judith Butler. The letter is around 2,300 words long, about the length of this sermon. So it would take me around 20 minutes to read it out loud to you, so I won't. But as I understand the letter, which is thoughtfully worded and carefully argued, I think his point is mainly summarized in this sentence. If you are white, I ask that you don't run to seek shelter from your own racism. If you are white, I ask that you don't run to seek shelter from your own racism. It's not my work this morning to convince you that Yancey is correct and that all white people to some extent or other are racist. But I do want to do is to encourage you to read his argument for yourselves, if you haven't, and to consider deeply what he is saying and how he is saying it. George Yancey, an African-American scholar who has spent a considerable amount of time discussing race issues with some of the brightest thinkers of our time, is begging all white Americans to at least consider that we are racist. He has reason, of course, to fear that white Americans will not listen to him. White America doesn't even like to acknowledge, really, that there's such a thing as white America. The dominant culture doesn't usually know about itself, do we? Like the air we breathe, we don't notice it and can't describe it. What is white culture? What's it like to be white? People of color can often answer these questions about white culture and white identity, but white people rarely can. A 2010 article in Psychology Today describes white culture and notes in particular that white people relate to each other as beings devoid of race. We don't think of ourselves as having race. So when we're asked to do things like describe white culture, what are white values, beliefs, behaviors, celebrations, rituals, aesthetics, most of us can't do it. We don't know how to describe white culture, and our inability to do that is part of white culture. So I think it's a good thing for white people to begin to understand what it is to be white. And we should be able to approach a letter that begins, "Dear White America," with open minds and open hearts, not with premonitions of fear or anger. It is the experience of many people of color that white people, even liberal and progressive white people, are extremely difficult to talk with about race. I think that's why this is so important to what Yancey wants to say to white America, that we aren't even able to have a conversation if white people can't listen. So that seems sad to me. That seems like something we white people, those of us who identify as white, can work on. Our reading this morning about the angry white man who lashed out during a workshop on race issues comes from Robin DiAngelo, a consultant and trainer on issues of racial and social justice, in her paper on white fragility published in 2011 in the International Journal of Critical Pedagogy. The abstract of her paper is as follows. White people in North America live in a social environment that protects and insulates them from race-based stress. This insulated environment of racial protection builds white expectations for racial comfort, while at the same time lowering the ability to tolerate racial stress, leading to what I refer to as white fragility. White fragility is a state in which even a minimum amount of racial stress becomes intolerable, triggering a range of defensive moves. These moves include the outward display of emotions such as anger, fear, and guilt, and behaviors such as argumentation, silence, and leaving the stress-inducing situation. It's the end of that section of the abstract. White fragility is what D'Angelo felt she observed in the white man pounding his fist and shouting, "A white person can't get a job anymore," in response to hearing a definition of racism. He's kind of having a meltdown. And her theory is that he's just been so insulated from what she calls racial stress, in this case, just thinking about racism, that he kind of can't bear it. I find this idea of white fragility very compelling. I empathize with the people in the room with the shouting man who don't know what to say or do. I feel like I've experienced white fragility myself as a white person. I've had times in my past when even the phrase white people made me extremely uncomfortable because I'm not used to even being referred to by my racial identity. And I've certainly witnessed it in other white people. It takes Yancey almost half his letter to even begin to talk about race and racism. He is so accustomed to white people tuning out, not listening, or responding with anger and defensiveness that he spends the first half of his letter talking instead about sexism. How, as a man, despite his best intentions, he benefits from sexism and he perpetuates sexism. And having laid the groundwork that as a man he can't help but participate in systemic sexism, he then invites white people to see that we can't help but participate in systemic racism. I don't personally find the suggestion that all white people are racist to some extent or other to be that challenging or provocative. Maybe it has to do with where I went to college. Like, we learned that 20 years ago. I happen to agree with Yancey that racism is so embedded in our culture in so many ways, and I think we have a lot of deeply ingrained prejudices that are hard to shake. I think they rest in like the fear part of our brain. But what takes me aback about his letter, what really caught my attention, was how positive he seems to be that white people will refuse to consider what he's saying. Like I said, the letter would have been half the length if he didn't feel like he had to prepare us so much to hear it. He's convinced we won't even read the whole letter, that we'll reject his arguments and respond with accusations and hostility. And he believes this because in his experience, that is how white people respond to discussion of racial issues. White fragility, a state in which even a minimum amount of racial stress becomes intolerable, triggering the outward display of emotions such as anger, fear, and guilt, and behaviors such as argumentation, silence, and leaving the situation. In 1963, Martin Luther King wrote his now famous letter from a Birmingham jail. It is a letter written in response to 8 white religious leaders who had criticized the strategies of the civil rights movement. In it, Dr. King wrote of his grave disappointment with those white people who should have been his allies. He wrote, "I must confess that over the last few years, I have been gravely disappointed with the white moderate. I have almost reached the regrettable conclusion that the Negro's great stumbling block in the stride toward freedom is not the white citizen's counselor or the Ku Klux Klanner, but the white moderate who is more devoted to order than to justice, who prefers a negative peace, which is the absence of tension, to a positive peace, which is the presence of justice." End quote. It is over 40 years later, and Dr. King, sadly, is long dead. But I think it is only just now that we are beginning to understand and articulate the characteristics of white culture that Dr. King had observed back then. The white moderate who is more devoted to order than to justice, who prefers a negative peace that is the absence of tension to a positive peace which is the presence of justice. The absence of tension that Dr. King names is just what Robin DiAngelo means when she talks about white fragility. This Martin Luther King holiday, I invite you to be aware of this white fragility where you might observe it. Let's not be white people who refuse to talk about race, who become defensive when people of color tell us something, who lash out in anger when we're even slightly uncomfortable, and who remain silent as we witness the anger and defensiveness of other white people. The Black Lives Matter movement is creating an era of unprecedented racial dialogue and information sharing. All these articles on the internet about white identity, white privilege, white rage, white ignorance, these are good things. If they make us uncomfortable, that's okay. It's okay to be a little uncomfortable. There are worse things. We'll be all right. In honor and celebration of the memory of Martin Luther King, let's reject the negative peace that is merely the absence of tension. That peace is not real. It's empty. There's nothing there. No, instead, let's do as Dr. King invites and seek the peace that is the presence of justice. Let's fight for that peace. There cannot be racial justice in the United States until white people learn to join in the work of rejecting and dismantling structures of racism. To do this, we must be in right relationship with Black leaders in this justice work. And to be in right relationship, we must be able to listen and learn when people of color tell us about ourselves. We don't have to pretend to be Black to join in. We don't have to be experts or leaders, but we do have to do our part. Step one is to set aside anger, guilt, and defensiveness, and to listen to the stories and experiences and requests of people of color. Read George Yancey for yourself.